Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, and clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. End of the week, a warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Max. Coming up on the program today, a fresh face steps into the water crisis as South Africa's taps, pipes and patients run dry. A new political era is taking shape, but who gains, who loses and who merely survives? South Africa's motor industry faces a harder road as global trade turbulence hits the factory floor, and the artificial intelligence talent war is no longer coming. It's here, and companies are paying heavily to compete. It's Friday, the 3rd of July. South Africa's water crisis now has a new political face in the engine room of government. Jack Bloom, the Democratic Alliance's long-serving Gauteng veteran, has been appointed Deputy Minister of Water and Sanitation. And Bloom also steps into this new national office role during, I think, a fairly bruising time for the Democratic Alliance and the GNU, with the reshuffle, with Dina Pule being appointed as Social Development Minister, John Steenhuisen moved to a Deputy Minister, that of Trade and Industry, and the new DA leader, Jordan Hill-Lewis, facing questions over party unity. Lots to talk about. Jack Bloom, a very warm welcome. Congratulations on your new position. You've spent years exposing failure from the outside in the province. Now you're inside national government. What are you hoping to fix?
Well, you know, I do see this as a continuation of my health mission. You know, I've been health spokesman for the DA in Gauteng for more than 30 years. But of course, there are so many childhood illnesses and other illnesses caused by poor water and sanitation. And that has to be a big focus of mine. It's primary health care, and I do want to attack that with vigor. But of course, it's a far wider issue of, you know, we have a water crisis. And there's so much to do. There's the Green Drop reports on wastewater treatment are terrible. They show about 47% of them are in atrocious conditions. And frankly, you know, parts of the country might become unlivable if we don't have a decent supply of water. It's that urgent.
What have your years in Gauteng provincial politics taught you about why basic services collapse and what you might replicate in terms of a bigger national picture?
Well, you know, so often the budget is actually there, but there's just corruption and ineptitude and wastage. And I mean, if we take the Tembisa Hospital corruption, 2 billion rand was just absolutely looted. The question is, what if that 2 billion rand was spent on the patients at Tembisa Hospital? And I think there's lots of similar questions there. You know, I crossed swords with Nomvula Mokonyane when she was Premier of Gauteng. I was leader of the opposition then. And of course, she went on to become Minister of Water, and that's what delayed the whole Lesotho Water Highlands project. And that's part of the reason why we have a water supply problem to Gauteng. So, you know, I will not, you know, sort of compromise on high efficiency and corruption-free standards. In fact, you know, we have this huge problem of leaked water, wasted water. Well, the only leaks I want to encourage are people who are whistleblowers and can tell us what's going on. And, you know, we can fix the water system by getting rid of all the corrupt people. That's really a priority, I must say.
Deputy Minister, would you support tougher national intervention in municipalities that repeatedly fail on water and sewage?
Well, absolutely, because, you know, the problem is that's where the power of the president of the National Department ends because the municipalities aren't control, and really there needs to be stronger intervention. You know, they don't spend the budget, or they waste it, or they don't ring fence it, and there's massive wastage of water, and we can't go on like this where our failing municipalities are imperiling decent water, and there have to be strengthened powers, and there are amendments in to legislation in the pipeline. You know, I want to examine that more carefully, and you know, where extra powers are given, we need to use them.
I want to come back to stronger intervention in just a moment, but as Deputy Minister, realistically, what real levers do you have? You are surely dependent on the Minister, and you've got to seek cooperation from those failing municipalities that we're speaking about.
Well, I'm going to be meeting the ministry, and I think we've got to come to an understanding, and hopefully she sees the shared goal of all of us in getting things done. And I think that I can get things done, and within my role as a deputy minister, I will, you know, see the role, particular role that I can do, and hopefully I can do it effectively. But yes, I'm very conscious of that, and I'm really going to, you know, to see where I can make the highest impact. You know, I've always believed in the 80-20 principle. You know, what is the 20% you can do that will give you 80% of the impact? And I'm going to discuss that with the national minister, and you know, hopefully get buy-in for what I can meaningfully achieve as a deputy minister.
So what do you think stronger intervention nationally means then?
Well, it has to start with, you know, getting our failing municipalities, well, to pay their water bills, to stop this massive wastage of water, and in fact, hire qualified engineers, because that's another part of the problem, and just get our systems working. I mean, we cannot continue with collapsed municipalities leading to collapsed services and citizens in gigantic distress because of this.
What did working in Gauteng teach you about the limits of opposition politics when you're dealing with things like budgets, officials, and increasingly militant unions?
Well, look, you know, I've been in opposition politics for a very long time. It's more than 30 years. And, you know, it's the frustration of opposition politics is that you can expose things. And I did that with the Lapa Sedimeni disaster. And, of course, that brought that to a halt, which was, you know, very satisfying. And more lives would have been lost if I hadn't asked the questions that I asked. But, you know, nobody's actually been prosecuted for that to date. That's actually my frustration there. But, look, I'm now in the executive. You know, I could see the problems looking in. Now I need to come up with solutions. And look, you know, sometimes there are low-tech things you can do with a massive impact. You know, I did spend time staying in formal settlements. I wrote a book called 30 Nights in a Shack. You know, I did that for 2.5 years, once a month out to informal settlements. And I could see that, you know, just the basic provision of a few extra taps to existing water supply could benefit so many thousands of people. So that's a low-tech interventions that we need to do. But I'd like to explore high-tech interventions. You know, we've moved on. We've got artificial intelligence. We need to look at latest technology and try and do things that way. So that's the field that I hope I can contribute to meaningfully.
And just a final question, you are one part of a bigger reshuffle, and Dina Pule's appointment to social development, as you well know, Deputy Minister, has caused a huge amount of controversy. Does the GNU require you to swallow that?
Well, look, my political party has made its objections very plain. And yes, it is of massive concern. And, you know, going forward, we're going to watch this very, very carefully to see that that department is run properly. But of course, massive concern. I mean, it really it's problematic, but our party leadership is going to be looking at that situation very closely and protecting the interests of the public.
Jack Bloom is the newly appointed Deputy Minister of Water and Sanitation.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's coalition era is no longer a political experiment, but a permanent reality. And in her new book, Where To From Here, Political writer and Business Day parliamentary correspondent Tara Ruiz argues that identity politics, populism and weak coalition structures are reshaping the country's future. And she joins me now to discuss why some parties are thriving, others are fading, and whether South Africans are heading towards more fragmentation or perhaps a new political consensus. Tara, a very warm welcome and congratulations on the book. It argues that we've entered this age of uncertainty. Is that uncertainty, do you think, now the defining feature of politics in South Africa?
Absolutely. I think the defining feature of politics in South Africa today is coalitions and populism and the uncertainty that comes with both of those things. You know, for many, many years in South African politics, you knew the ANC was going to rule. You knew that the decisions that came out of the ANC, NEC, was going to govern the country. And for the first time in history, that is absolutely not the case.
Let me pick you up on that word populism. Do you think it's filling a vacuum then that has simply been ignored, abandoned, left by mainstream parties that have simply deflected and have stopped listening?
Absolutely. You know, when we look at the rise of populist parties, it can be directly linked to the government's inability to address key issues to South Africans. You know, if you walk down the street, Jeremy, and you were to ask someone randomly what they thought the biggest issue in this country was, they would either tell you it has to do with crime or it has to do with the economy, whether it be high employment, economic stagnation. And if you look at crime, for example, you know, it is populist movements that have been able to co-opt these key issues to South Africans that are not being addressed. You know, AfriForum will tell you that, you know, white farmers are the most oppressed in South Africa. Colored nationalist groups like the Patriotic Alliance, the National Colored Congress will tell you, actually, it's the child in the Cape Flats. That completely ignores the fact that 70 murders happen a day in this country. Everyone is affected by crime. It is not specific to one group only, but it is these populist movements' ability to co-opt these issues that are not being addressed and tailor it to their particular demographic to tell them, actually, you are the most vulnerable. And if you vote for me, I will help solve your issues because no one is listening to you.
And therein lies the problem. Voters agree on what the issues are, but have widely differing views on the solutions. And that, Tara, I would suggest, makes any kind of compromise almost impossible in the current paradigm.
Absolutely, because you are never going to please everyone. And the difficulty that I think we face today is that we don't have a unified vision of where we are going to as South Africa. We can agree that crime is an issue. We can agree that, you know, economic stagnation, high unemployment, these are issues. How do we fix those? I think is where we have really lost South Africans. When we look into post-1994 and into the early 2000s, South Africans are reunified in the direction of the country. And today, I think that there is a large splintering of that direction. And many South Africans actually don't know what the future holds for us as a nation.
And the consequence of that splintering is, as you write, coalition politics. Does it encourage, as it should, better accountability and cooperation, or, as we suspect, simply rewarding backroom deal-making?
I think we do lack a lot of maturity in our coalitions currently. I think that there, as a part of a evolving and growing democracy, maturity does come. You know, there is a stark difference in the first year of the GNU versus the second. But I think when we look at the lack of political maturity, particularly at a local government and provincial level when it comes to coalition politics, I don't think that we are at a time yet where coalitions are actually very fruitful in allowing for accountability and allowing for diverse voices to be heard. Currently, where we are right now, it is about who can undercut the most, who can play politics, the game of politics, the best. And I think that ultimately that is not the most productive outcome for South Africans.
And that doesn't bode well for Johannesburg in the upcoming municipal election, does it?
Absolutely not. You know, what has happened in the city of Joburg, Jeremy, has been absolutely devastating. When we look at the lack of governance, the lack of political will, the lack of cooperation to make the city work. You know, Joburg is not only the economic heart of the country, it is also a massive role player on the continent. You know, if Joburg fails, South Africa fails. And I think when we look at the inability and the lack of political maturity for a working coalition to survive in the city of Joburg, I think it does give residents very little hope going to the ballot in November this year.
And Tara, in the book, you talk about winners, losers and survivors. But the reality of the situation is the party facing the greatest existential threat right now is the African National Congress.
Absolutely. You know, the ANC was the biggest loser in 2024. They are likely to be the biggest loser again in 2026. And I talk about this in the book, Jeremy. You know, the problem is that the ANC, despite all of its failures, is still the most popular party in the country. South Africans like the ANC. They like ANC policies. They do not like ANC governance and the ANC's track record in governance. And the ANC's problem is that they're not honest with themselves about the reality of South Africa and what they particularly have done to South Africa through their bad governance track record. And I think until the ANC is honest with themselves, there will be no change in their electoral outcomes.
And on the other side of the divide is the Democratic Alliance that you write has a messaging problem.
They have a messaging problem and a growth problem. You know, the DA, for all intents and purposes, is a massive communications and PR machine. When you look at DA marketing, you would believe that the DA is doing absolutely amazingly. You know, they were the official opposition for 20 years. They finally entered government. The DA's entrance into government is not because of their own successes, but because of the ANC's failures. They actually lost almost 100,000 votes going from 2019 into 2024, and they've lost 600,000 votes since 2014. And when we look at that decline, the fact that the DA is the official opposition for 20 years was unable to pick up a single vote despite the ANC's watershed election in 2024 is a clear indication that the party is not growing.
And just finally, beyond the municipal election, do you think we are then moving towards, in time, a more mature coalition democracy, which is what South Africans want, I imagine, or maybe more worryingly, an era of permanent instability and this fragmentation that you've referred to?
I hope that we are nearing the end of this instability coalition period. You know, the longer we have coalitions, the more and more they mature. Coalitions at a national level are still very new in the democratic history of South Africa. And it is really my hope and my wish that we will see greater political maturity and cooperation at a national level, a provincial level, and a local government level, because coalitions are here to stay. It is unlikely for the foreseeable future that any party will get 50 plus one. And I think that is a reality that political parties need to accept. And I think that there needs to be greater efforts to make coalitions work in South Africa.
Well, for my money, one of the best political books that I've read in recent times. It's called Where To From Here, Populism and Coalition Politics in South Africa. And the author is Tara Roos. Tara, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
On to the automotive industry now, and global trade is becoming more hostile, more expensive, and less predictable. And South Africa's sector is right in the firing line. Tariffs, supply chain disruption, localization pressure, and failing infrastructure forcing many manufacturers to rethink where they source parts and how much they make locally, and whether South Africa can still compete inside the big global vehicle value chains. Someone with a view on that is Kumani Pitso from Isuzu, South Africa. He's Executive Vice President for Procurement and Logistics. Kumani, a warm welcome to you. Are South African vehicle manufacturers genuinely adapting, or are you simply absorbing one global shock after another?
Thank you, Jeremy. South African manufacturers are really, adapting, and strategies have been set in place to be able to be resilient and withstand all these global shocks. If you look at, for example, an Isuzu, how we approach this is, our focus has been more integrated from supply chain point of view, because when you're sourcing, you're looking at the resilience of your supply chain. And hence, when our strategies, we start looking at localizing to minimize the impact of global disruptions. So South African manufacturers are really adapting. And you can see that with the investment that we've made recently of just over 510 million rands in localizing components to be able to sustain ourselves during the global disruptions.
Let me put this to you, though. Localization sounds good politically, but can South Africa actually produce at the scale and quality that global manufacturers actually need?
Certainly. The standards that we set in the automotive industry is that irrespective of where the parts are manufactured, The requirements are the same, you know, from quality point of view. You take an example, and actually we're even more stringent. You take an example in South Africa for Isuzu, where we have a local rear axle supplier. They've designed and built a, you know, purpose-specific rear axle for Isuzu, which is strengthened for African conditions. So our local manufacturers have the capability to compete globally, and even going the extended route of, you know, knowledge transfer, skills transfer, technical support, I think we can even take it to the next level. So we can really compete at that level from South African point of view.
Point taken, but are they able to move at scale as far as that is concerned, given that those supply shocks seem to be coming with more regularity?
I think that's where the key comes in, right? Scale is very important. So we need more volume. We need to get them to grow. We need to start, exporting more of our components and exporting more of our vehicles. And then that will really get us into the right space. But in terms of the basics of skills and knowledge, we're the right place. But we just need to actually get more volume to be able to compete at global level.
You talk about skills and knowledge, and I do understand that. And often within your industry, supplier development is promised, but many smaller suppliers still struggle to break into the automotive value chain. Is that true?
Well, it is true. It is. I mean, the requirements technically are very, very high in terms of automotive industry, in terms of quality, what you need to achieve. The likes of Isuzu, our focus has not only been on giving money to buy equipment, but our focus has been more on the, you know, technical skills, has been more on that know-how to make sure that the suppliers can sustain themselves. So we've seen in our space where we've incubated a number of suppliers, and they've really gone to graduate and become our, you know, suppliers going forward. So there are suppliers who are coming in. The focus just needs to be not only on investing on equipment, but also on the skills to make sure that the suppliers can sustain themselves going forward.
You might get that side of things right, but difficult surely to build a resilient supply chain when ports, rail and power in this country still remain unreliable.
Absolutely. An integrated approach is very important. When you're talking supply chain resilience, I always say we look beyond our organization and not just the resilience within our operation, but we need to look at our suppliers and, to your point, you know, the ports that our materials are coming through, the infrastructure. And we do have an integrated approach we work on with our suppliers to make sure that we minimize the impact of any disruption coming from that space. The positive aspect, obviously, is with infrastructure. You can see Eskom has really improved the, you know, energy availability. And, recently Durban and Kuka has been noted as some of the most improved ports. So it's positive on that aspect, but we do follow an integrated approach to protect ourselves from any disruptions.
But fair to say that South Africa's infrastructure is now your biggest threat when it comes to competitiveness.
Yes. The infrastructure anyway is quite critical to have the best infrastructure or to have the functioning infrastructure. Yes, we've had challenges in South Africa, and we've seen progress. I mean, I've mentioned the utilities and I've mentioned, the ports. But what's still important is for us as manufacturers to find ways actually to manage around that, but also to see the improvements that are coming in the logistics sector as well as the utilities, and being sustainable in the long term.
How much rope do you actually have? Do you think global manufacturers are becoming less patient with South Africa's structural problems?
I think there is some confidence. I mean, you look at the regrading in terms of the investment grading for South Africa. There is that confidence that has been built into the country that South Africa is an opportunity for growth. So I think there is really that confidence. I mean, bringing it back home, Isuzu has gone out and said, hey, let's invest over 500 million rands because we believe in South Africa. We believe in the continent that there's great opportunities. So we're quite confident with that.
And just a final one then, if government wants more local manufacturing, and it's been very clear about that, what do you think it needs to fix first?
I think the focus needs to be on, you know, government is responsible for the policies that enable us to have more manufacturing. So I think the policies need to be reviewed in a way that supports more investment in local manufacturers, make it more viable, not only for big corporates, but also for smaller enterprises to come in. If you look at the South African automotive industry, we have a large number of tier one suppliers, but tier two, there's a shortage. So we need to see a lot of, you know, the policy upgrades or updates that will actually talk to real economic growth, or real ability of manufacturers and investors to invest into local manufacturing. So policies are very important to make sure that they are realistic and talk to the reality of growth in manufacturing.
Khomani Pitso is Executive Vice President for Procurement and Logistics at Isuzu South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The AI talent war is no longer just about hiring tech specialists. It's now about retaining a new kind of employee, a person who can use AI to produce the work of a small team. There's some new research out from the Top Employers Institute. It suggests the so-called AI orchestrators, and this is the figure which I find absolutely astonishing, already commanding a 56% wage premium. And that obviously is going to raise tough questions about pay, performance and retention. Well, let's put that on the table. Sandra Boete is with us, Global HR Auditor at the Top Employers Institute. Sandra, welcome to you. And what exactly is an AI orchestrator? And how is this person maybe different from someone like you or me that would be using ChatGPT or Claude or other AI tools?
So what we see is this new role of the AI orchestrator. And that is a new role because it changes how one person can coordinate multiple AI systems to deliver outcomes that previously required actually an entire team. So this type of person suddenly blurs the boundaries between jobs, because we see that now marketing starts overlapping with analytics, or finance overlaps with automation. Because this person can now almost double or triple the contribution that they used to provide in an organization purely by using the systems effectively.
It's astonishing, because if one person can now produce team-level output, as you're suggesting, across multiple disciplines within an organization, I guess the notion of traditional job descriptions don't make sense anymore.
Exactly. So we can't still look at the same job description that's been written and placed on a file for the last couple of years. And coupled with that, one also needs to relook the salary structure, because now we are looking at this person's output quite differently. It's less about, for example, how many reports somebody can write or how many meetings they attend, but it's more about the value that they are creating and the decisions that they're making that are improving problem solving for the organization.
Which I guess begs the question, how then does a company measure performance when, as you're suggesting, Sandra, value comes from judgment, prompting workflow design and AI leverage rather than hours worked or meetings attended?
Absolutely. So managers need to start looking at recognizing these new capabilities. So things like judgment, prompting AI effectively, validating AI, and orchestrating multiple AI systems. These are the type of skills that are now coming to the forefront. They are increasingly determining a person's performance, but yet they don't appear on most performance review forms today. And those are the type of skills that we now need to focus on and looking at how we reward that, rather than looking at the traditional job description.
But difficult to judge a person's ability to judge, right?
Very difficult, but it's about how that person is using the tool effectively. So that is why, at the end of the day, the system's output is one thing, but if that output from the AI system is highly effective and we can see the impact it's making on the business, it's not about the system itself. It is about how the person behind that prompted the system and used his or her judgment to get that right output.
And I'm just wondering whether this might create a fairness problem inside an organization where this new type of person, this AI orchestrator, just pulls ahead of their colleagues in similar roles. Again, something that senior management needs to take heed of.
Absolutely. The danger that we have is that many organizations don't recognize how much more value the people are bringing to the table. And I'm not talking about new hires only. It's very often experienced employees who have now really learned how to combine their expertise with these AI tools. And if they are still on the same job title and earning the same salary, the organization's competitors are going to recognize the value of these individuals before they do. And they are going to recruit your top talent. So it's no longer even about whether you can afford to pay an AI premium, but it's about affording that you can't lose the current people that are creating that value inside your organization.
And that premium is now a living reality because you reference a 56% wage premium. Sandra, where does that come from? And is it now a real warning rather than just a salary benchmark?
It is absolutely a real scenario. I think for the last 2 years, organizations have focused on adopting AI, but this next challenge is much harder. Because organizations need to look at redesigning the work itself. They need to redesign their job structures or architecture, and they really need to redesign their reward structure. And yes, I mean, it's daunting, the 56% wage premium, but now we need to think of how much is it going to cost us to replace these high-value employees when our competitors start recruiting them from our organizations.
But it's a conundrum because in South Africa, Sandra, where many companies are cost sensitive and under huge pressure, a 56% premium for AI talent isn't really realistic, is it?
I mean, look, 56% is an average that we now see typically happens in the market, but it's obviously depending on one organization to the next. And what we also need to really take into consideration is it's not only about the money side of it. Very often, these high-performing individuals want different types of recognition. What we see, for example, is that flexibility is very high as a priority for these individuals. And then we need to look at aspects such as well-being. We need to look at skills development and other ways on how to retain this top talent. So I think it's more a holistic picture that we just be very aware of who is our high talent, using this new AI in a very effective way, and what is it that we need to do as an organization to retain them?
How things are changing, and changing very quickly. Sandra Buerta, thank you very much indeed. Appreciate the insight. Global HR Auditor at Top Employers Institute. And that's where we're going to end the program for today and for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday, and we're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.